every windy, blustery day it was that way. Okay, got a faithful few here today. Oh, here comes some more. We want to say a few more things about the imperative mood here, finish up this chapter, and then take a look at the A and B of the exercises I gave you. If I don't get a chance to say it, for tomorrow we'll be doing C and D of this exercise, and we'll finish that up. So, yeah, that's a longer one. So, go ahead and do that for tomorrow. And looking at this chapter then, left off around page 163, talking about the uses of the imperative and the difference between the aorist and the present imperatives, mainly at one of aspect. Well, my marker indicates the top of page 263. Maybe we didn't get that far. Yeah, page 263, section 332. We were talking about the difference in aspect between the present and the aorist, and the present giving more of this progressive idea, keep on loosing, so forth, and then the aorist getting this more aggressive idea, start doing something. That's our kind of rule of thumb. Looking at the bottom of, then he's got examples here on page 262. Pursue love, diokete ten agathein, keep on pursuing love. In other words, it's to be a considered a long range and continual pursuit. Pantote chairete, always rejoice. There again, it's appropriate to use the present because it's always be rejoicing. Hekaste ton idion andra echeto, let each woman have, and again the implication is to continue to have her own husband. And ho blepes grapson es biblion, there we saw that it's start writing. In other words, write what you see in the book. It's not that he's been continually writing and now he's going to continue. It's rather that he's to start writing. So this distinction is fairly useful as far as a rough and ready way of looking at it. However, some consideration needs to be taken to the fact that sometimes it may not always be appropriate in every respect. He gives an example here. Give us in the Lord's Prayer, give us, if you translated this the way you were doing before, it'd be start to give us our daily bread and let thy will start to be done. So when we talked about some other possibilities here for the aorist as far as more of a indefinite aspect maybe more of an immediate need, you know, just focusing upon the need rather than on a progressive idea in this context. So as I said yesterday, it would be good for someone to do a more thorough research on this to really, you know, these are some of the fine points we'll be wanting to get into later on this year. Okay, and then it's also something we ought to be watching for in our translations. We've got a lot of things to watch for, you know, and we're not going to remember them all necessarily, but before long, once we get through the textbook here, much of our classroom work is going to be, we'll all have the text in front of us, and we'll be going through and translating, and we'll be not just translating for the purpose of just an exercise alone, but we're going to be drawing attention, calling attention to these grammatical points as we run into them. And so we can do a lot more evaluation of these things along those as we're actually translating and noting things as we go. Okay. Well, he gives a few more things from the Lord's Prayer here as far as aorists. Then the safest rule then for translating the Greek imperative is to use the simplest English forms unless the context indicates that the aspect of the verb is of special significance. So again, you're being guided by context. Now, thirdly, the negatives used with the imperative mood are may and its compounds. So imperative not being indicative. So we've seen with the indicative we used u. And we already saw that with participles and infinitives we used may. Now we're seeing also that with the imperative you're going to use may for your negatives. And in the next chapter we'll be dealing with subjunctive, and you'll find the subjunctive will also use may with its negatives. So you're going to use may now to negate these imperative forms. The translation of these negative commands or prohibitions parallels that of positive commands. The present imperative is thus used in a prohibition in which someone is commanded to stop doing what he is doing, whereas the aorist imperative is used in prohibitions in which someone is commanded to not start doing something. Now, of course, if you follow the same kind of distinction between the aorist and the present, The present, remember, in a positive command would be to continue to do something. Now, if you make that a negative, it would be don't continue. In other words, stop. The idea is you've been doing it, so don't continue. The idea is stop. Now, on the other hand, the aorist, if the aorist meant to start doing something, then the negative aorist would be don't start doing something. Don't start it. And so the negative, in other words, follows the pattern that the positive forms had established. Now, he gives some examples here. Meketi hamartane, sin no longer, or stop sinning. See, he's using the present imperative, and so using the negative on that, it means to stop sinning. And then ho ento agro me epistrepsato opiso, let him who is in the field not turn back. Okay, the idea there is, it's an aorist form, and let him in the field not start to turn back. Don't even start to turn. So that little nuance is something we want to watch for, because it's going to give a little bit more spice to the way things are said sometimes, and illuminate things a little bit more. As before, this distinction cannot be pressed in every instance. The aorist imperative occurs only quite rarely with negatives. Its place is taken in such constructions by the aorist subjunctive. We're going to get to that in the next chapter. So very rarely will you actually see an aorist imperative in a negative command, because it's not too often that you're saying to somebody, don't start doing something. And not only that, but a negative in that area is covered more frequently by the subjunctive. The subjunctive that we'll see in the next chapter is really a rather common verb form in Greek. You see subjunctives quite frequently, so we'll be probably seeing a lot more of those than we actually see imperatives. And it's kind of nice in a way, because subjunctive is one of the easiest verb forms to recognize and to form. And we don't have a lot more memory work ahead for us in the next chapter, which is nice. Okay. Yes.
Is it true what he says then, that we shouldn't press the distinction every time?
Well, I suppose, it's hard to know just how strongly to evaluate a statement like that. I think we'd have to just check. There aren't very many examples of it, and that's what makes it difficult. If you had a lot of examples, you could probably evaluate it more thoroughly. I guess we'll just have to leave that part for more research and so forth to really verify it. I haven't checked enough of the examples of this, since it's a relatively rare one, to see whether this thing. In the examples he gives here, it certainly seems to hold fairly well as far as the context and so forth. It's in no longer stop sinning, in other words, and then not start to turn back. That follows pretty well. The question is, does it in every instance? Sometimes he may say it doesn't in every instance, just because the theology gets involved, and I'm not sure what's the case there. So I'd rather hold on that and leave that for evaluation, and use this as a rough rule. And then as we actually do some translating ourselves and we notice things, we maybe compile some data there. And then I'd really like somebody to do a thorough study on it, just to see what we come up with. Yes, Greg.
You may have addressed this yesterday. The plural, second person plural, and both the present, middle, and active, I noticed they're the same as in the
right.
Indicative.
Did
you
right.
make any comment about in terms of how to distinguish it, or
yeah.
You just have to take a guess?
Right. Well, take a guess sometimes, but hopefully the guess will be guided by the context to some extent. In other words, context is your only help there. And in the instances where the context does not settle it for you, then, of course, I think the safest for exegetical purposes, for translation purposes, you may just have to come down one way or the other. But for exegetical purposes, you should express the fact that the form is ambiguous and it could be either one. And if either one fits the context, then draw some conclusions on the basis of that fact. It may, in fact, be a purposeful ambiguity. In other words, a situation where both apply and both should be taken. Usually that's the case. If the context will allow both, then a person needs to consider both in terms of the impact of it. And that's about all we can say about it. It's difficult sometimes, you know, and that's one of the more common forms too, the second person plural, because when you're giving imperatives, you see, giving instruction, that's, you know, very oftenly, commonly addressing a group in a plural sense. So those questions will come. Okay. Greek is better than English on a lot of these things, but you see, intonation would sometimes tell you. If the person is speaking it, the intonation would tell you, but it's in written form, that's always the more difficult. Okay, do we have any other questions on the imperative so far? All right, let's look at those exercises. The first section is drawing some observations here about what you've seen, and we really talked about all these things yesterday. And then the second section, 43B, is doing contract verbs. So, as I said, if you came in late here, 43C and D will do for tomorrow. I didn't assign those for today, but go ahead and put down 43C and D for tomorrow, and we'll go through that tomorrow. Okay, 43A. Indicate by placing T or F in the space provided whether the following statements are true or false. Number one, all forms of the aorist imperative have the augment. True or false? Okay, that's false. That's false. In fact, none of them do. Then, number two, some forms of the aorist imperative have the augment. That's still false. That's still false. None of them have the augment. Augment is an indicative mood indicator, really, as well as past tense. You don't see it in any place else. Okay, then, number three, the second person plural present indicative active is identical in form to the second person plural present imperative active. True or false? Yes, that's true. Okay, that's what we just talked about. Number four, the second person plural present indicative middle and passive is identical in form to the second person plural present imperative middle and passive. Is that true or false? Yeah, that's true. That's true also. So in the presence, both in the active form and in the middle and passive forms, you find that the second person plural forms are the same for aorist and, imperative and indicative. Now you see a full parsing description now. Now we've gotten this far, we get the full description. There's six pieces of information. Second person, plural, present, indicative, active. So you've got quite a mouthful when you give a full parsing form here. So we've got person, number, tense, mood, and voice. So we've got five pieces of information there. Okay, then number four, Number five, the second person plural aorist indicative active is identical in form to the second person plural aorist imperative active. Okay, that's false. There is a difference in those forms. Number six, the second person plural aorist active indicative middle is identical in form to the second person plural aorist imperative middle. Okay, that's false also. And then number seven, the second person plural aorist indicative passive is identical to the second person plural aorist imperative passive. Okay, that's false also. So it's true for the presence, but it's false for the aorist, that the second person plural forms the same. It has a lot of questions for one little point there, I guess. Now, 43B, refer to paragraphs 172 and 326 and form the present imperative active and the present imperative middle and passive of contract verbs. Now, the reason they're giving you presence rather than aorist, because the aorist would be too simple. Because the aorist has a sigma there, and so you don't get any contracts involved. So for the a-o verbs, present imperative active, you take taking agapa plus zero plus epsilon, so what becomes agapa. So that's in the third person. He's giving you part of the forms here, and then you have to fill in the rest. So the form you have to fill in is second person plural. Agapa plus epsilon plus tab becomes what? In your contracts, then. Yeah, interesting. Anybody? Agapate, yes. Agapate, alpha, tau, epsilon. Alpha, tau, epsilon, and then a circumflex over the alpha there for that contraction. Then the third person, agapa plus epsilon plus tosan. What would that be? Agapatosan, right. Agapatosan, alpha there, tau, omega, sigma, alpha, nu. Present imperative, middle and passive, agapa plus zero, it gives you that one, agapo. Then third person, agapa plus epsilon plus sto becomes what? Agapasto, right, agapasto, alpha, sigma, theta, omega. Agapa plus epsilon plus the is agapaste, right, alpha, sigma, epsilon, alpha, sigma, theta, epsilon, excuse me. And then here you have to fill in the whole thing. It should be agapa in the first blank plus epsilon plus sigma, theta, omega, sigma, alpha, nu. And the form would be then agapastosan. Agapastosan. For the e-o verbs, skipping through the second person down to the third person there, should be poie plus epsilon plus tau omega. And that becomes poieto, p omicron iota, epsilon iota, tau omega. Then poi, the second person plural should be poia, p omicron iota epsilon plus tau epsilon, becomes poieta, p omicron iota tau epsilon, the circumflex over the epsilon iota there. And then third person plural poia plus epsilon plus toson tau omega sigma alpha nu becomes poietoson, p omicron iota epsilon iota tau omega sigma alpha nu. Okay, now you have to fill in the entire thing here, present imperative, middle, and passive. You know, you should start with second person singular should be poia. In fact, poia and all the entire first column there is poia in all of those forms. And then zero for the middle form here, this stem formative, and then zero, and then omicron upsilon for your case number suffix. So that would become poiu. That's p omicron iota omicron upsilon. Then we have poia plus epsilon plus sigma theta omega. That becomes poiesto, p omicron iota epsilon iota sigma theta omega. We have poia plus epsilon plus sigma theta epsilon becomes poiesta, p omicron iota sigma theta epsilon. And then poia plus epsilon plus sigma theta omega sigma alpha nu becomes poiestosan. Poiestosan, P omicron iota, epsilon iota, sigma theta omega, sigma alpha nu. Okay, and the OO verbs give you the first example there, playro plus zero plus epsilon becomes playru. Then you come, the third person form should be playro, back to playro in all of the first column there. Playro plus epsilon plus tau omega becomes playruto, P lambda, eta rho, omicron epsilon, tau omega. Then the second person plural, playro plus tau epsilon, and that becomes playrute, p lambda eta rho omicron upsilon tau epsilon. Then the third person plural, playro plus epsilon plus toson tau omega sigma alpha nu becomes playrutosan, the omicron and epsilon contracting the omicron upsilon. So you get p lambda eta rho omicron upsilon tau omega sigma alpha nu. Okay, then the last part here, present imperative, middle, and passive. You should start with second person singular is play rho plus zero plus omicron upsilon becomes play rho, as they give you there. Then the third person, play rho plus epsilon plus sigma theta omega becomes play rusto, p lambda eta rho omicron upsilon sigma theta omega. Then the second person plural, play rho plus epsilon plus sigma theta epsilon, play rusta, p lambda, eta rho, omicron epsilon, sigma theta epsilon. And then the final one, the third person plural, play rho plus epsilon plus sigma theta omega, sigma alpha nu, becomes play rustosan, p lambda, eta rho, omicron epsilon, sigma theta omega, sigma alpha nu. Any questions on those forms? It's just a matter of applying the contract rules that you've had before. You just, you know, once you've got the endings, it's just a matter of combining it. Yes?
I have a question on the next page, 43.
Yes.
Those phonological changes that, other than what we saw in
mm-hmm.
chapter 43,
any of the ones applied? Oh, as far as phonological changes, reiterated that the same things can happen when you're adding sigmas and thetas as happened before. I don't think there's anything in addition to that that comes in. Let me think. See, so you're going to get the softening before the theta. In other words, when you're adding the theta in the aorist passes, you're going to get, like for example, pempo here, pempe. You're going to get pimp theta, for example, for the aorist passive form. You're going to get a phi there before the theta. That's just following what you saw before, so maybe that's what you had in mind. Or the c, you know, when you add the in the aorist form, aorist middle imperative, pimp psi, you're going to get the c. So it's just those same phonological changes you've seen before. I don't think there's anything in addition to that, though, that I'm aware of. Okay. So you can work on that, 43c and 43d. Probably take you a little longer than this exercise did. You can use ditto marks as much on 43D there, where you just have to convert Says transform the given sentences with adverbs in the indicative mood and sentences with verbs in the imperative, retaining the person, number, aspect, and voice of the given sentence. So if you want to, the rest of the sentence isn't really going to change. All that's going to really change is the verb form. So if you want to just put the verb form transformation and then put ditto marks for the rest, it'll save you some time writing things out. Okay, any other questions? All right, let's proceed then to chapter 44 in the subjunctive mood. There's two chapters on this, chapter 44 and 45. 45 is taking another step with the subjunctive mood and getting into relative clauses and subordinate conjunctions that use the subjunctive. That's one of the most common uses of it. So let's look at chapter 44. The subjunctive mood is very nearly obsolete in English. It still occurs frequently in quote-unquote unreal situations, such as the if clauses in "if I were you, I'd get a haircut." And this form, "if I were you," the "were" there is considered a subjunctive. It's indicating a possibility or probability type of situation rather than a real situation. So "if I were you," he's not claiming to be that other person, he's just saying "if that were the case." So hypothetical situations are often shown in the subjunctive type of an idea. It is also found in poetry and in old-fashioned stories. "Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones and make my bread." You know, "be he alive or be he dead." The "be" there in both places, I don't know where he picks these phrases, but he is showing a subjunctive use there. It's not saying that he is alive or dead. It's just "be he alive or be he dead." That's a subjunctive form. "And though he strike me dead, I'll still tell the truth." Now notice the form of "strike." "Though he strike me dead." That's a subjunctive form. See, your normal form, it would be "he strikes me dead." The normal third person form would have an S on it. But this subjunctive form has no S on it. So those are some archaic remnants of subjunctive in English anyway. The forms of the English subjunctive are mostly identical with those of the indicative, except that the third person singular of the present subjunctive has no S. "He strike" in the last illustrated sentence. The present subjunctive of "to be" is "be," and the past subjunctive is "were." Okay, that's about all you can say about subjunctive in English. There's not a whole lot involved in it. And the forms are generally about the same as the forms of the indicative, and then its context is telling you that, although with some of these forms there is a slight difference. Now, as far as Greek is concerned, though, you're going to see subjunctives a lot more frequently. Section 334, the subjunctive mood in the New Testament, in New Testament Greek, occurs very frequently and has many uses, most of which do not correspond to the uses of the English subjunctive. So we'll see Greek subjunctives in a lot more positions and places than we'll see English. And they'll do with subjunctive what English does with other types of constructions. The forms of the Greek subjunctive, moreover, are usually, though not always, easily distinguished from those of the Greek indicative. Happily, the forms of the subjunctive add very little to the load with which the Greek verb imposes on the memory. This is some, you know, it's nice to get one of these breaks once in a while. Those of the model verb "luo" are given below. The corresponding indicative forms are also given to facilitate comparison. So let's look at this. In the boldface type here, you see the subjunctive forms. And for the indicative, and for the present active, the indicative form "luo," the subjunctive form "luo," the identical form. So there's no difference in this in the first person singular. But then notice "luais," and then "luais," same pronunciation, but the spelling's different. You've got an "ada" with the "oda" subscript there in the subjunctive. And "luae," then it becomes "luae" also, but "ada" with the "oda" subscript instead of "epsilon" and the "oda." Then "luo men" becomes "luo men" with an "omega" instead of an "omicron." And "luete" becomes "luete" with "ada" instead of "epsilon." And "luusi" becomes "luosi" with an "omega" instead of "omicron" and "upsilon." So to make an observation about it, I suppose one could say that in general the subjunctive is going to lengthen the vowel sound. And you get either an omega or an eta. And if you look at all of these subjunctive forms, they've all got either an omega or an eta in them throughout the entire paradigm. So that's kind of an indicator. I mean, it catches your eye right away. And their subjunctive forms are relatively easy to identify because of that feature. Now, of course, your first person singular in present active would be ambiguous since it's got an omega in the indicative also. but the rest of the forms are different, and they're pretty easy to identify. That aorta subscript in the second and third person singulars, too, is another tip-off. You see a verb form with an aorta subscript in it, and you're immediately saying subjunctive, and it just kind of hits your mind immediately. So recognition isn't too bad. And then, of course, really what's happened here is you really don't have a difference. If you remember the way that those suffixes were split up, and if you just consider a stem formative and then the suffix, the only difference about the subjunctive really is the stem formative. The suffixes themselves are, well, they're pretty much the same. I guess I'll have to qualify that a little bit. That aorta subscript can perhaps be considered part of the suffix. So in the second person's and third person singulars, you may have actually a different suffix. But it's really not too difficult to identify these and recognize them when you see them. So looking then at the present, middle, and passive forms, same kind of thing. We've got luomai for the first person, then luomai in the subjunctive with an omega rather than a omicron. Lue and lue, that's the same, both in the indicative and subjunctive. Luetai and luetai, get the epsilon goes to eta. Luomatha and luomatha, omicron goes to omega. Luesta and luesta, epsilon goes to eta. And luontai and luontai with omega, you see. So all except for the second person form there, it's just a matter of lengthening either an epsilon or an omega to an omicron to an omega and an epsilon to an eta, and you have the forms. Okay, too bad they all couldn't be like this. Then up in the top of the next page, your aorist active, indicative and subjunctive. We've got elusa and then luso. Elusas, luses. Elusa and then luse. Lusamen and lusomen. Elusamen and lusomen. Elusate and lusate. And elusan and lusosi. Well, there's quite a bit of difference there, but what do you notice about those subjunctive forms? Just by looking at that paradigm, what kind of rules would you give for formation of it?
Does it have the same endings as in the present?
Right, same endings. And the only difference then would be just the sigma. Just adding a sigma to the base, and then the forms would be identical to the subjunctive in the present. In fact, this is kind of, you might expect this almost to be like a future form. I'm kind of following the analogy of the future. Remember, the future didn't have an augment, just added a sigma, and that had the same endings as the present. Well, that's in effect what's happening here, although it's aorist rather than future. And so we have no augment in the subjunctive. We have the addition of the sigma, and then we have these other endings. Now, you won't get confused with the future subjunctive because there is no future subjunctive. So that's fortunate. So to form the aorist, you're using the same endings you had when you formed the present. And so it's going to look a little different than the indicative. You're not going to have these thematic alpha-type endings. You're going to have these subjunctive endings, and it's going to be a little bit different form. But if you just remember that, remember that sequence, there's not too much difficulty to it. The aorist middle, under the same analogy, is just... you've got elusamen and then luse, and so forth. It's just adding the passive endings, passive subjunctive endings that we saw back there on the same thing as the present, only now with the passive type endings. And then the aorist passives, if you look at that, you've got lutho, luthes, luthe, luthomen, luthete, luthosi. What do you see about that as far as the endings are concerned? Well, yes, there's a theta in the base, theta in the base, and then what about the ending itself?
Present.
Yeah, same as the present active endings in the subjunctive, except that there's an accent. The accent goes into the last, onto the ending there, and a circumflex all the way through. So if you just remember to put a circumflex on all the forms and put the same endings you had on the present, you've got the aorist passives also. The thematic, I mean, that tense form of theta there, of course, is going to be an indicator of the aorist passive as well. But no augment, the stem lu plus theta plus the present endings again. So the ending systems are quite nice through all of these. And this is it as far as the Greek has no future subjunctive, no imperfect subjunctive. So all we have to worry about is present and aorist. And that's it, just like with the imperative. Okay? So good news there. All right, now, section 335. Yes, Greg?
I noticed that the other thing we had seen before, but it seems to be even more common. There's a number of different cases where they have the same, like Lue and the present active subjunctive and the third person thing are the same as in the present middle subjunctive. And I've seen that.
Oh, yes, yes, good point. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen another
whole,
like luso,
mm-hmm.
And the aorist active subjunctive is
going to
be the same as the future, first person future.
Oh, yes, that's right. The luso and the subjunctive is going to be the same as just luso for the future indicative, and that, again, is going to have to, you're going to have to rely on context for it. There's no way around it. Usually there'll be sufficient indicator in the context, but we've seen this before even with some of the contract verbs. Some of these forms turned out to be identical. And because the contractions came out the same way. And here the same is with the lue there with the third person singular subjunctive in the present active, and then the lue that is your second person middle and passive subjunctive is the same form. There, if the subject is stated, then you can tell right away. In other words, if it's a third person, and if it says so-and-so and gives their name and they did that, then you know it's third person. There's no question about it. If it's... you see, usually between third person and second person, it's usually not too much confusion because it's either a conversation where somebody's being addressed and then second person is appropriate, or it's a narrative in which another person's being described and so forth. And so you seldom run into a real problem on that one. As far as this future form, though, I think you probably have more of a chance of running into a problem on that one as to whether something is subjunctive or future. And sometimes even the semantics of the thing is almost similar. The idea of a subjunctive is getting into this realm of possibility, this might happen, and so forth, and the future is more, this will happen. And sometimes there, you know, the places where those kinds of verbs would be falling into context may make it more difficult to decide between the two. So that's one you probably have to watch. Okay, any other questions? The rest of the forms would be distinguishable, though, because the future forms would have the endings appropriate to the present there, and they would all be different. Okay, let's look at the observation here as far as the analysis of all of this. And like I said, again, this analysis is interesting, but it may not be the quickest way to memorize the form. First of all, the analysis of the subjunctive forms into constituents follows that already made for indicative imperative forms. First, the base, in this case, lu. Second, the prefixes, the forms of the subjunctive mood never have the augment. Prefixes which do occur with the subjunctive will be discussed in Lesson 46. Now you might be wondering in your mind, what other prefixes are there besides the augment? Well, Lesson 46 is going to be dealing with prepositional prefixes primarily. In other words, where you put an ek or an en or something like that on the front of a verb. And that's true not only of subjunctive, but of the indicative forms and so forth. And so that's what he's referring to there. He's not talking about some particular suffix that's used with subjunctive and not with something else. He's talking about these other compound verbs, is what they call them, and chapter 46 we'll be getting into those. So, but as far as tense type or time-associated prefixes, over there aren't any in the subjunctive. Okay, then tense formants. We have the sigma, as we've had before, attached to the base of the first aorist active and middle. Then we have the theta attached to the base in the first aorist passive. So that's just like what we've seen before. Then the stem formatives are either omega, eta, or zero. And it's omega before nasals, mu and nu, zero before suffix beginning with a vowel other than the iota, and elsewhere it's eta. Like I said, I think it's quicker just to memorize the paradigm than to try to remember that. Then the suffixes, they separate them into primary A and primary B. No secondary suffixes here. There's just this primary A and primary B as far as these subjunctives are concerned. And primary A, you got omega, then iota sigma and iota, and of course they put in parentheses the iota is a subscript, so that may be a little different than we had before. Then men, te, and osi, with omega there, so it's slightly different in the omega one there. Then the primary B's are my, a, tai, mitha, the, and nu, tau, alpha, iota. Those are identical to the ones we had before, the primary B suffixes from the regular verbs that we had before. So remark number one on the top of the next page. There are no secondary suffixes in the subjunctive. We noted that. Note that the primary A suffixes differ from those of section 169, part 1, only in the third plural, and that the primary B suffixes are identical with those of section 169, section 2, part 2. Okay, we just observed that. Remark 2, important, the vowel, vowel of the ending, that is, the vowel omega or eta, always has the circumflex accent in the aorist passive subjunctive. So that's something we observe too. So we always put the circumflex on it in the aorist passive. Okay, and the rest of the forms just seem to follow the normal recessive accent rule, where the accent tries to get as far forward as it possibly can according to the rule. So whenever you have a long, syllable at the end of the word, then it's going to be on the second to the last syllable, and when it's got a short syllable, it's going to be on third to the last. Okay, then. Section 336, verbs which have second aorists in the indicative also have second aorists in the subjunctive. The suffixes are the same as for the first aorists. So formally, there's not going to be much problem here. Remember when we had a second aorist back in the indicative, we used the suffixes for the imperfect and the stem change. Here, we're going to have a stem change, all right, but the suffixes are going to be the same. So the only way you're going to be able to tell a first or second aorist in the subjunctive is just by looking for the stem change. The endings are going to be the same. So the second aorist active in middle subjunctive forms of lapo, aorist indicative active of active elliphone, and the second aorist passive subjunctive forms of grapho, which is the second aorist, are given below for illustration. So this is true both of the passive and of the active and middle. We've got lipo, lipes, lipe, lipo, lipomen, lipete, liposi. In other words, it's just a matter of having that stem change from lape to lip and then adding the same endings you would have added anyway. And lipomai, lipe, lipetai, and so forth, these endings are exactly the same as we've seen with the first aorist. And then the second aorist passive has the same endings also. What would be the difference between a second aorist passive and a first aorist passive then, formally, as far as the subjunctive is concerned? What would be your only indicator of a difference? Yeah, the stem change. And generally that's going to involve, as far as the second aorist is concerned, the lack of the theta. There'll be no theta on your second aorist forms, there will be in your first aorist form, so that's the thing to watch for. The endings will be the same. Of course, they were the same in the indicative also, the ending system for the aorist passives. Any questions on that? Does that all make sense so far? Okay. Section 337, verbs which are deponent in the indicative are deponent in the corresponding forms of the subjunctive. Ginomai has present subjunctive, ginomai, gine, ginetai, ginomatha, gineste, ginontai. In other words, it's got those passive type endings, the middle and passive endings for the subjunctive. And these are the subjunctive type endings. Notice they've all got those etas there. So it's straightforward. And aorist subjunctive is genomai, gene, genetai, genomatha, geneste, genontai. There you have that stem change, but the same ending system, basically, those passive type endings. So the endings, see, for genomai and genomai, the only difference between those forms, if you look through the entire paradigm, is one's got an epsilon and one's got an iota, gen versus gen. And in subjunctive, that's the only difference between them, between aorist and present. Okay. So that's something you have to kind of watch for, too. Make sure your eye picks up the epsilon versus the iota. Then there's also genetho, genethes, aorist passive forms. It's got middle and passive forms, remember. And so the passive forms are a little bit easier to see. You get the theta in there, genetho, genethes, genethe, so forth. But so you've got two possible sets of forms for that. Erchomai has present subjunctive. Erchomai, erche, erchetai, etc. Same, follows the same patterns. Aorist subjunctive, the aorist subjunctive is eltho, elthes. See, there you get a stem change for the aorist, and so the forms are going to look quite a bit different, and it's still got active forms here, as it were. So that's what we saw. I mean, in other words, it's doing the same thing. It's not really deponent. It's irregular, but not deponent in the aorist. You're getting active type endings. Well, I guess you could probably call those the passive, eris passive, but it's quite, not quite, no, I guess you couldn't. That theta is just the part of the stem, part of the stem change, because the descending system doesn't have the circumflex on it. It's just the same thing we've seen before. Okay. So the subjunctive does the same thing as far as first and second eris and deponencies as the indicative did. Then section 338, in the present subjunctive of contract verbs, contraction occurs in accordance with the rules given. Now this again would only occur in the present, because in the aorist you have your sigma that would break up that contraction. So they give you an exercise, 44B, the same kind of thing we did here with contract verbs, so we'll get to that later on. No assignment on that yet. Section 339, the me verbs. Tithe me and histe me are regular in the subjunctive, so that their paradigms may be given an outline only. In other words, all you need to know is what the stem is, and then you can figure it out. For tithe me, it's titho, tithes, tithe, etc. Titho my, tithe, tithe tai. In other words, just you have tith and plus ascending system. Histe me, well, it's looking down at the aorist active. Tho, face, they, all you got is the theta left from the original word, and then you put the ending on. And aorist middle, so forth, all those are straightforward. Aorist passive, tetho, tethes, tethe. Just a matter of knowing what this unusual stem is and then putting the endings on. So the ending systems are regular. Histe me, same thing. Histo, histes, histe, etc. Aorist passive, statho, stathe, stathe. Other than that, it's pretty straightforward. But ditto me has some irregularities. So they set aside ditto me here from the other two in the subjunctive because it has some differences. And I suppose the predominant and obvious feature, if you look through these paradigms, for your present active, present middle and passive, aorist active, aorist middle, not the aorist passive, but all of those, you'll notice stem formative, is omega all the way through. See, normally we've had both etas and omegas, but for didome, for example, it's dido, didos, dido, instead of didae and didace, you see what you would have expected before. It's didos and dido, didomen, didote, didosi. So it's omega all the way through. Present, middle, and passive, same thing, omega all the way through. And it's got a circumflex in all the forms except the third person, first person plural, didomatha. Aorist active, do, dos, do, domen, dote, dosi. So you can pretty much get those by just taking the di off the present active, and we saw that happen before. Aorist middle, domai, do, dotai, so forth. Omegas all the way through. So for some reason, this didomi is, you know, like the omegas, likes O sounds. And so it just kind of dominated over the eta sounds, and everything's coming out O sound. The aorist passive being exception to that, though, that goes back to the old system. Do, tho, do, theis, do, the, do, homen, do, theta, do, thosi. So the aorist passive doesn't follow that, but all the rest of the forms just are using omegas all the way through. So the irregularity in the subjunctive, it didn't make consist in the fact that it has omega instead of eta in all forms. Notice, too, they give you some optional forms for the second person and third person. Didois, didoi. This oi sound instead of the omega, and that's also true of the aorist. And apparently the aorist does have, in that third person, it could be either do, doi, or doe, any of those three forms. Yeah, right. Probably your accent, yeah. Okay. Any questions other than that on this? Okay. Then the subjunctive forms of the verb ame are as follows. Okay, these aren't too difficult. Again, it's just basically endings. So my print is so terrible here. I can't tell whether that's a rough or smooth breathing. It looks like smooth to me. So it'll just be O, ace, A, omen, ate, OC. Okay, just putting a circumflex over the endings, basically, in smooth breathing. Okay. Now, as far as the meaning concerned, the subjunctive, we're going to get a beginning of this here in this chapter and then some more refinement in the next chapter. We now turn to the various uses of the Greek subjunctive as they occur in the New Testament. All right, it should be borne in mind that the forms of the Greek subjunctive will rarely have to be translated by forms of the English subjunctive. Okay, just because English doesn't use subjunctives that much, We probably won't see a lot of translations of an English subjunctive verb form. But we'll do it with other types of clauses or phrases, things like the word might or may or something like that. We'll use auxiliary words, or we'll use intonation patterns, or you know, various ways of expressing this idea of subjunctive. This is not to say that the subjunctive in Greek doesn't mean anything or is not worthy of paying attention to. It's just that English is different than Greek in this respect, and once we learn the idea of a Greek subjunctive, we'll find ways in English to try to express that. Okay, first, now when he breaks this down, now he's going to talk about the hortatory subjunctive, the prohibitory subjunctive, the deliberative subjunctive. These are just grammatical categories based on observation of how a particular grammatical device is used. So it's not that the grammar has certain categories built into it or automatically designed into the language. These are observations based on grammarians' analysis of how a particular thing is used. We're going to see this more later when we talk about the case functions again, too. And we'll look at lots of kinds of genitives, subjective genitives, objective genitives, and this type of thing. We're going to be categorizing those and breaking them down. Those categories are just observations based on a grammarian's look at how the thing happens to be used. And he says, well, this use is kind of like this one. We'll put all these in the category. We'll call this objective, we'll call that subjective, and so forth. So that's the kind of breakdown that we're seeing here. And he's got a footnote down here. The names hortatory, prohibitory, deliberative, and so on refer to the meanings of the subjunctive in various uses. They are traditional, but are at best convenient labels. As names, they are quite unimportant. Well, hopefully the name has some correlation to how it's used, you know, so they have an importance that way. But I think his point is that they're not something intrinsic to the language. All right, the hortatory subjunctive then. Subjunctive is used in the first person, usually plural, but occasionally singular, in main clauses to express exhortations. That's where the term hortatory comes from. It's an exhortation. This hortatory subjunctive is sometimes introduced by aphes or aphete, which are forms, aorist imperative forms of aphiemi, and they may usually be rendered let or left untranslated. So aphiemi means to let or permit, something like that. So it's using, you know, you start off, let this happen, or permit this to happen, something like that, and then go to the subjunctive form. Or duro or dute, to be rendered come, if translated at all. So you might see these words introducing a hortatory subjunctive type of situation. You may not see them. Some of the examples here don't have them at all. You may just see it as subjunctive form. So look at John 14:31. We see agomen en tou then. Let us go hence. Okay, agomen is a subjunctive form. And so the idea of let us is coming from the fact that it's subjunctive. Let us go hence. And this is kind of like the cohortative for the Hebrew students. It's like the cohortative in Hebrew. It's functioning kind of that way, the hortatory subjunctive. And may genomatha kenodoxoi. Let's not become conceited. Okay, here again we're seeing may as the negative. May is going to be used with a subjunctive. And the subjunctive is giving the idea of let's not become conceited. And then aphes ek balo to karphos, let me cast out the mote. Okay, aphes here is more of an explicit expression of the idea of let, although without it, you still get translated approximately the same way. It's got a little bit more emphasis this way, though. Let me cast out the mote. And ekbalo there is your subjunctive form. Although in this case, you wouldn't be able, the form is the same as the indicative. Remember that first person form. So your context is going to have to tell. The aphes certainly helps you here, because that's a typical indicator of this kind of a clause, and subjunctive would be the appropriate form to use.
Do you think that's why they put it there and not in the first case?
Well, that's possible. And without having seen all the examples, it's hard to say for sure. If there may be, in other words, if there's an ambiguity in the form, they may put the office in there just to resolve the ambiguity, unless you know you're talking about a subjunctive. I'm sure that's a possibility. It's hard to say unless they do that consistently. But maybe in this particular case, even if they don't do it every place else, to do it here, just to, you know, resolve any possible ambiguity, it would certainly be an appropriate reason for it. Okay, got five more minutes here. The prohibitory subjunctive, this was alluded to earlier when we were talking about the aorist imperative. The aorist subjunctive is used in the second and third persons, singular and plural, in main clauses to express a prohibition or negative command. In all such cases, of course, the negative may is used. Okay? So instead of using an aorist imperative, they're using an aorist subjunctive when they want a negative command. And here's an example, Hebrews 3:8, scleronte tas cardias pneumon. Do not harden your hearts. Okay, scleronte here is an aorist subjunctive form, and it's a command, do not harden your hearts. And the idea of the subjunctive there, remember, is expressing possibility, probability. That's usually the general gist of it. And when you're making commands, especially prohibitions like this, it's not inappropriate to see a connection between the idea of the subjunctive and the idea of the imperative. In other words, let it not become a possibility that your heart's hardened. You know, let that not even be a probability or possibility. I suppose that that's maybe one way to connect the thoughts anyway. They're not completely divorced from each other as far as their meaning is concerned. And this seems to be the more appropriate way, the far more common way of expressing a negative command is to use the subjunctive rather than the imperative. 1 Corinthians 16:11, mei tis un auton exuthenese, let no one despise him. Again, mei with the aorist subjunctive form, indicating a negative command, let no one despise him. And you get a feeling of a little bit more politeness to it too, using the subjunctive. It's not quite as direct, although it, you know, sometimes politeness can be more forceful than impoliteness. You know, especially when you're talking to somebody you love, and you bring a command in a very polite fashion, like the Apostle Paul does sometimes. The impact of that, you know, it's like Paul when he's talking to Philemon and asking him to. You know, politely asking him to set Onesimus free. You know, it's the poor man Philemon. What could he do? You know, how could he say no after an appeal like that? So it's forceful, but it's a little bit more polite. It's like for the Hebrew students, putting that nah on the imperative. It kind of softens it a little bit, but then on the other hand, it makes it more of an appeal to the heart, you know. So sometimes it's got more force in that way. At least among Christians, it would have more force. Among the heathen, it may not. Okay, then, more important, two points should be remembered about the prohibitory subjunctive. Number one, it occurs only rarely in the third person, as in 1 Corinthians 16:11. Again, because when you're making a command, you're usually going second person. You're usually talking to somebody. The third person idea would be kind of like with the imperative, where it's like this jussive idea in Hebrew, where you're expressing your wish for somebody else, a third person that you're not specifically addressing. So as a result, it's going to occur far more less frequently in that kind of a sense. He gives a couple of other verses here, 2 Thessalonians 2:3 and 2 Corinthians 11:16, that use the same kind of construction, but it's not very common. Then more important is its relationship to the imperative mood. We saw in Lesson 43, Section 332, that the present imperative is used in a prohibition in which someone is told to stop doing what he's already doing, and that the aorist imperative is used in prohibitions in which someone is commanded not to start doing something. The aorist imperative, it was also pointed out, occurs only infrequently with negatives. In its place, the prohibitory aorist subjunctive is used. Some examples will make this clear. Okay, for a present imperative, me kerusata would mean don't preach or stop preaching. Using the present imperative, you see, the idea is a continuing action type of situation. And then to negate that is to try to stop the continuing action, of course, and the idea of stopping preaching would be appropriate here. But then the aorist subjunctive form, me kerusata, would be don't preach or don't start preaching. In other words, if you want to prevent them from starting something, this is the way that it's normally done. Now, you could have done it with an aorist imperative, but they don't normally use an aorist imperative. They rather use the aorist subjunctive in this kind of situation. And there may be some exceptions to it, but he's going to give you a rule of thumb for workbook exercises. And so in doing exercises in the workbook, the student should not use the aorist imperative with may, but the aorist subjunctive. In other words, when you want a negative prohibition, use the aorist subjunctive, not the aorist imperative. just to follow that rule of thumb, because that's predominantly the way it's done in the New Testament. And then on the other hand, he should not use the present subjunctive with may to express a prohibition. He should not use the present subjunctive with may to express a prohibition, as it was not so used in the New Testament. In other words, the present subjunctives aren't being used this way. If it's present, you use the imperative for a negative command. If it's aorist, then you're going to use the subjunctive for a negative command. That's just the way that it happens to be done. And I don't know how that corresponds to classical Greek, whether the classical Greek follows this or whether this was a development of the Koine, I'm not sure. Okay, that's all the time we have for tomorrow. Like I said, 43B and C and D, we'll go through that, and then we'll finish up the subjunctive chapter and maybe look a little bit at those subjunctive exercises.